round 11 of the MotoGP World Championship in difficult conditions is underway.
Hello and welcome to Motopod, the internet radio show all about motorcycle road racing. This is episode number 506 for Wednesday, the 24th of August, 2016. My name is Len Padilla, coming to you from La Rasuaña, Navarra in Spain. And with me is Harry Lloyd from somewhere west of London, if I'm not mistaken. Is that right, Harry?
Yeah, I think it's to the west. I just had to do the quick never eat soggy Weet-Bix to figure out which way was west in my head. But yes, Reading is, to the best of my knowledge, west of London. Reading, not quite as fancy as where you currently are, but so far it's doing just okay. And to make the situation either a little better or a little worse, depending on how you look at it, that is the sound of yet another energy drink as my downward spiral of life continues.
Yeah, well, I'm not drinking an energy drink. I'm drinking the universal solvent, just a glass of water.
That's much healthier than me and probably much better in the long run. But we do have a pretty massive show for you this week. We had a huge amount of listener feedback, and we also had a pretty exciting weekend in the Czech Republic. It's a bit odd that there's an Australian and an American doing this show when it was a very British weekend. But, you know, there's probably some joke about the colonies in there.
Yeah, well, we'll be nice to them. We'll be nice to them. I think they've earned it.
Yeah, exactly. So first things first, a big, big, big thank you to James Pretoro, Neiman Bean, and Steve Helmuth for your continued donations that do help the show keep chugging along, as I always say. Motopodcast.com down the left-hand side. You guys and gals out there probably know the drill already. There's some PayPal links. You can do a one-off donation, or like James, Neiman, and or Steve, you can do a recurring donation, which is hugely helpful. And it does do things like make sure that all the hosts can watch the MotoGP race, and also helps Dave get out to Silverstone. And we'll have a little more details on a bit of a Silverstone meetup in the coming days. So be sure to check Facebook and Twitter, where we are Motopod on both of those. On Twitter, it is Moto_pod. That's your best bet to keep up to date with any IRL or in real life meetups that are happening for Motopod.
Yeah, well, thanks, guys. Like Harry says, it keeps the wheels turning, so we super appreciate it.
Yep, and the only thing that we love more than donations is your emails, and those can be sent to motopod@motopodcast.com. And as I said, this week we've had a fair few listener emails. You know, they do come and go. Sometimes there are listener emails that just get piled on by the hosts. So sometimes we've already sort of talked about them in nauseam. But we do have a nice little collection here on a wide variety of topics. Some will spoil some other bits in the show, but don't worry. I'm sure if you're listening to this podcast, you more or less already know what happened at the Grand Prix. So first of all, from Philip Johnnies, this is all about Ducati wings. Ducati have put the effort and money into development of wings/winglets, which appear to help keep the front down, both in corners and a wheelie inhibitor. They like the wings, you could say, and next year the wings are banned in MotoGP. Ducati have, this is me talking, not reading the email now, Ducati have made one or two complaints/grumbles about the wings being banned, but it is what it is. Now back to Philip's email. So what are the options for Ducati if they feel that the wings are giving them an advantage they don't wish to lose? My lay assessment of options are A, rip them off and forget them, so to speak. B, design a fairing that has wings inside of the outer skin, ? Not being an engineer and an expert on the MotoGP regs, I don't know if option B would pass the scrutineers. Would a fatter fairing profile degrade the aerodynamics to outweigh gains in downforce? Just a thought, and would be grateful for your comments. I really must get out more. Cheers, Phil. So on option A, I know that Casey Stoner at the Austria test was testing the bike for almost the whole weekend without winglets, with sort of a look towards 2017. As for option B, you could probably do something inside the fairing, but I'm not sure how effective it would be.
Yeah, I this is something that I've been thinking for a while. I definitely think now that the cat is out of the bag, so to speak. I think Dorna have created a little bit of a problem for themselves, because they're going to have to define, you know, what exactly is a wing? Is a fairing that's shaped in a way that it produces downforce? You know, when the entire fairing is the wing, then what do you do? So I think, and I think that's where we'll end up. I genuinely do. I think it's certainly not hard to create a shape with the fairing that generates some downforce. And so that's going to be, rather than tacking the wings on, I think what they're going to, they might actually end up riding wings. So I think it'll be interesting. 2017 will be interesting to see what the teams come out with. I don't, judging from Gigi Deligna's take on it in the technical press conference the other day, I don't think he's ready to let it go.
Nah, it does seem like he's holding on to it for dear life. But as you say, what does justify a wing? Could they start to do something to the nose/front fender region of the bike and, extend it out to make it a bit more like an F1 nose or something to get that to help? And it is going to get a bit tricky for Danny Aldridge and his technical inspectors, I think.
Yeah, it'll be interesting.
So now we have an email from James Dewitt, who says, all happy for Cal, winning his first GP. As I said, there would be some spoilers. Giving us the longest string of different winners in a row since 1999 and the most new winners in a season since 2006. But here's a bit of a pinch. Two of the air quotes surprise winners have been from independent teams. In the wet and on the bike that everyone in the paddock is saying is way too aggressive and extremely difficult to ride. Yet the super stable, smooth as butter Yamahas and the sweet handling Suzuki have struggled in comparison. Is the RC213V that the independent teams have a somewhat softened version that is actually playing into riders' hands in the wet? And those are those riders extremely lucky, or did everyone else just bugger up so badly that a painfully crash-happy bike is also relatively relatively consistently winning in the wet? I know Cal made the astute choice with the tyres and others suffered from extreme degradation, but he still had to nurse the bike for the first few laps to avoid adding to his impressive DNF stats. I don't doubt that if any of the factory bikes had fitted the hard rain tyre combo, they would have been ahead, or at least battling closely with Cal, but in the sack string, the Hondas were up there. In Assen, it was a Honda 1-2. Something to think about, and hopefully this means Hondas can be across the board more sensible soon enough. Though knowing Honda next year, it will be an even lighter crank. So first of all, I think it is very important to point out that in the Czech Republic, Cal's tyre choice did play an absolutely huge part. As James rightly pointed out, it seems like the soft tyres had a huge number of problems. Dovi had a terrible front tyre, Lorenzo had a terrible front tyre, Iannone had a terrible front tyre. So that's one important point on that one. Then as for the Suzuki and the Yamaha, I know that up until now, the Suzuki's big problem in the wet is that Suzuki just haven't been able to get the electronic settings working for the wet. Whereas it seems like Honda either have the settings for the wet on the electronics working very well, or Cal Miller / Marquez are just able to more or less ride without electronics, or right, with highly reduced electronics sort of thing.
Yeah, and it also seems, besides the electronics, to fine-tune it, it seems, from what I've read, of course, not having ridden the bikes, but it seems like the basic settings of the Yamaha and the Honda are quite different. The Yamaha is a bike that pitches a lot less, puts a lot less stress on the front tire, and that might have been the way that they tuned it as a reaction to the early performance of the Michelin front tires. Whereas the Honda is a very pitchy bike, putting a lot of load on the front, and that might actually be working for them. What we've seen so far is that in both in cool conditions and in wet conditions, the Honda seems to be working real well. And the Yamaha only wants to work well when it's, when it's hot.
Yeah, and also with Yamaha, I have to remember that two out of their four riders aren't exactly great in the wet. We've seen Jorge Lorenzo, who might as well have stayed in bed in most of the wet races. Pol Espargaró is not really known for his ability in the wet. Rossi is obviously quite good in the wet. And then Bradley Smith, who's usually good in the wet, he's having a really tough year with Michelin tyres. So, there's also the riders to take into account, but it definitely does seem that, much like the Ducati when they were struggling, that that the wet does bring out the best in Honda and Honda riders. Of course, the flip side that Yamaha riders are struggling in the wet, it could be that that Honda riders excel in the wet. Both Miller and Marquez certainly like the bike a bit loose and are happy to slide it and have the bike moving around under them. Whereas that's probably something that, Jorge Lorenzo doesn't like. So that plays into their advantages in the wet. And I think it's a combination of a lot of factors. But, we saw in the Czech Republic again that also the Ducati is very strong in the wet. It's just that they sort of suffered from tyre choice.
Yeah, I think it seems to be that both of the, at least the factory Ducati riders, expected that it was going to dry out, thought they'd go for the soft to, to do what they could while it was still wet. But it just never quite got dry enough.
No, unfortunately not. We will go into that in a bit more depth once we do get to the race results, but we still have a couple more emails to get through, like this one from Will Meyer. I'm pretty sure that's Meyer, not Mayer. Meyer. Like most fans, I clearly remember Romano Fenati sitting on the grid by himself with his arms crossed waiting for everyone else. It seemed a wonderful display of bravado. However, I have a theory as to what actually happened. No one wants to get to the grid first. You don't want to wait there with your tyres cooling down. Fenati simply forgot himself. Getting to the grid so early was a mistake. He eagerly zoomed around the track, arrived on the grid, looked around and realized his mistake, and then realized the entire crowd's eyes were on him. I strongly suspect he crossed his arms in embarrassment and anger. It looked great, but I think it was early evidence of his poor judgment and temperament. When I was in grade school, I got so mad at another kid on the playground that I decided I'd hit him with a chair, as you do. I went inside, got a chair, came outside, and abruptly realized how stupid I looked carrying a chair out to the playground. So I set it down and sat on it with my arms folded. Fenati looked much less an idiot than I did, but I still believe his pugnacious pose was a reaction to embarrassment. Obviously, Fenati has some real talent on a bike, but he's never been able to keep his head together well enough to do anything with it. Hopefully, his recent firing will be a wake-up call, and he'll rise to the occasion and prove all us naysayers wrong. Cheers, Will. I'm not sure that Fenati's little stunt in Mugello that year was a mistake. I think that he probably knew exactly what he was doing, and that at that moment, as you rightly say, Will, that that's when we really saw sort of the unfiltered Romano Fenati. You know, that first season, he had a huge amount of confidence and he was at his home GP for the first time. And I think that he is, you know, all these hormones and testosterone and all that sort of stuff just took him over, and he thought, I'm going to make this moment about me. And that maybe that should have, as you say, raised one or two flags before eventually coming to the explosive end, to the explosive pause, shall we say, in his racing career that happened in Austria. Interesting you talk about his head. I definitely agree that Romano Fenati's head is the real problem here. I was speaking to Brad Binder before the Czech GP, and, you know, I sort of said, oh, you know, must be nice knowing that you only have to worry about Navarro and not Fenati. And he said, to be honest, I was never really that worried about Romano Fenati because he can't win for more than, you know, one in five races. So why should I worry about him for the championship? So I think that was also pretty telling about how seriously other racers take Romano Fenati.
But it's funny, you know, I agree. It's easy to, you know, with what's happened to say, oh, you know, that Romano Fenati, he's a nutcase, you know, and kind of dogpile on him. But I think that's what endeared him to a lot of people. You know, there were a lot of people that... you know, and I still have that burned into my head. I remember him sitting there with crossed arms, and I thought, wow, that's, you know, that's unfiltered confidence and bravado. And, you know, and there's some of that that's kind of cool. But the problem with confidence is when it works for you, it's fantastic. Mm. When things aren't working so well, you look like a real idiot.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, Fenati did have a lot of idiot moments. You know, there was the whole switch and kicking and punching Nicholas Ayo incident in Argentina a couple of years ago, and you know, you always heard rumors that within the Sky VR, within the VR46 Academy, he wasn't really liked. He was a bit of a black sheep there, and it sort of seems like, yeah, everything just came to a head in Austria. We'll get to it in a bit, but there are already some rumors coming out about where Romano Fenati's future could be, because, you know, as Will rightly said, Fenati does have talent. You know, you don't win multiple Grand Prix without having, you know, some talent deep down inside you. It's just whether he can get into a structure that can get that talent out consistently and, you know, sort of maybe not change his thinking, but maybe streamline it or refocus it.
Yeah, I think the good thing for Fenati is that he will get another chance. You know, it might not be as good as the ride that he's currently on or as great as the situation, you know, with the ranch and all of that. But, you know, he'll get something else. I just hope that he's got the right people around him that will let him know that, you know, hey, getting a second chance is lucky. Getting a third chance is probably almost unheard of.
Yeah.
And I think, like you mentioned in last week's show, maybe the best thing to do would be to send Romano to Australia, hook up with Anthony Gobert, and let them hang out for a couple of days. Let him see if he would like to, you know, to go that route.
I'm not sure that Romano Fenati and Anthony Gobert really operate on the same wavelength.
Certainly not. But, you know, sort of the scared straight approach.
Yeah, probably. I legitimately have not heard anything about Anthony Gobert in at least 5 years.
Yeah.
I must try and find out what he's doing.
Yeah, I think the last story is the story that you mentioned about him, you know, unfortunately stealing somebody's purse, and you know, it's just a sad story. It's a very sad story because, you know, he's
again, yeah, huge potential talent,
unbelievably talented, yeah, and just out of control.
Yep, exactly. So now, on last episode, I also posed the question about the potential ship-to-shore radios that some riders had been asking for. We got a couple of answers about that one. First answer from Jarrett Bean, a long-time listener, friend of the show, Jarrett Bean, that is. I vote no on the radios. I think it takes away from the spirit of Grand Prix racing. The rider knows what he/she needs to do in that particular situation. Aside from not being able to hear a radio over the howl of a GP engine, it seems dangerous. Even if you could manage to build a system with quality sound to hear your crew chief, being fed lap times and gaps while you're tipping into turn one at Phillip Island doesn't seem safe. Concentration is key. Too much information seems distracting. On a side note, I swapped helmets with a friend on a recent ride. His helmet is equipped with a Bluetooth speaker, and it was difficult to hear at highway speeds. Combination of wind noise, poor speakers, and a V-twin engine. Downward thumb pointing emoji sent from my iPhone. So, yeah, I definitely agree with Jarrett on that. We also had an email from Naomi, not sure I'm going to be able to pronounce your last name.
Siba.
Thanks for that, Len. First of all, I really enjoy listening to the show because I travel a lot. Not to other countries, that would be nicer, just to downtown. Well, thank you for listening to the show, Naomi. We enjoy making it. Anyways, I wanted to write in on the topic of radios about pit-to-rider communication. I'd like to give an example from F1. I watch it even though I'm not a big fan of it. Fair enough. Yes, it is a show element when you hear Kimi Raikkonen complain about the blue flags. Yes, it helps the drivers with millions of buttons on the steering wheel, but it also helps drivers to drive, which sounds kind of ridiculous given the fact that they're the best drivers in the world. And the same thing would happen to MotoGP. It would help, of course, in communicating penalties. People would know definitely about a penalty and time gaps to the riders. And of course, the show element of a rider telling the crew he doesn't care would be added. I'm sure that Jack Miller and Cal Crutchlow would come out with at least one or two colourful lines. But on the other side, it would take away from the excitement of a flag-to-flag race. Rider A just pitted on slicks and is 5 seconds quicker than you. Box, box, box. Pit wall to rider B. And the most important thing, and the sport would just become autopiloted. It can't even be regulated. Yes, you could say that you can only share certain types of information, that's a rule, but what do you give out as a penalty and how do you really restrict it? You know, this has also come up in F1. There are two penalties before all of the regulations came in, and then they got deleted and then they got brought back in, and that was all a mess. So Naomi believes MotoGP should not have radios in any way, and seeing it in F1 week to week hasn't convinced her of it either.
Yeah, and I think her points are valid, but I think the underlying thing in both of these is I'm sure they could make it work. I have no doubt that, you know, you get the right audio engineers together and you get the right systems, and they'll be able to communicate back and forth crystal clear, no problem. I don't think that's the issue. I think it's one of, and I think it gets down to this, you know, I heard somebody talking the other day about they don't think that MotoGP is real prototype racing because of all the rules. And I think that's kind of looking at it the wrong way. It's, you know, you could have something completely unlimited, you know, in terms of communication, in terms of technical rules. But I think, you know, when you engineer something, constraint is important. You know, it's important to decide, you know, what are the things that I'm going to do and what are the things I'm not going to do. And I think that I just think that it would. I think it's more of a philosophical thing. You know, technically, I think they could make it work. But I like the idea of that something that's really important when these guys are racing is, you know, is how well do they think? The fact that the racecraft is something that they decide, not a committee back in the pits deciding what the best thing to tell them to do is. But I have to say, I'm not against radios. What I'd actually like to have is I don't want the pit crew to be telling the riders things. I want to hear what the riders are saying during the race. I think that would be much more entertaining.
That could be pretty good. But yeah, that could be pretty good, you know, especially if, Cal Crutchlow, we're going to be talking about him a lot this show, but he has a tendency to get quite dramatic out on track, especially, you know, if someone's taking a toe off him in qualifying. So I agree, you could definitely get one or two pretty exciting sound bites from Cal Crutchlow telling Hector Barbera to go jump in a hole or whatever.
It might be good because, you know, I know myself, I've been known to, you know, talk to myself a little bit while I'm riding on track. And talk to other people as well. So it might be, I don't know, I think it would be interesting to hear what these guys have to say when they're writing.
Yeah, I hope that the whole system at least gets, you know, maybe one test in the postseason or something, just purely from a curiosity point, and to see what riders really have to think about it, you know, whether it is plausible. As I've kind of made clear, I think that, you know, in a race, and as Jared and Naomi sort of said, that it does take away, and as you said yourself, Len, that it does take away from that element of racecraft. But, you know, just for a video feature on MotoGP.com, I'd like to see it at least.
Yeah, and I think where they're going with being able to send messages to the dash is interesting. You know, also in terms of safety, you know, if something really goes haywire on the track, it's nice to be able to alert them, or to give them, you know, the black flag warnings to call them into the pits, whatever it might be. But you know, again, we'll see how that shakes out. But hopefully, that's going to be, you know, very, very limited.
Yep, exactly. Yeah, the whole pit board to rider thing is definitely something that I think, you know, as we've said, does sort of strictly need to be controlled, and, you know, not able to give any more information than you have in your pit board. But anyway, we have had a bit more silly season news going on since the last episode, with now there only being one open seat in MotoGP, that being the second Aspar seat, and that will likely go to Yoni Hernandez. It's now time to focus on Moto2 and Moto3 silly season, and Romano Fenati is, of course, at the centre of much of it. Romano Fenati has been linked to a ride with Gresini in Moto2 next year. Italian rider, Italian team, sort of makes sense. But Jorge Navarro has also been linked to a Gresini ride in Moto2. I'm not sure that Jorge Navarro needs to move up to Moto2 in any rush. I think that he could really benefit from sticking around next year and taking a title. You know, we saw with Brad Binder, he took a fair time in Moto3, and it's clearly not hurting him. I'd definitely like to see Romano Fenati get another shot, you know, purely just for the drama that he will no doubt bring with him.
Yeah, I mean, like I said earlier, you know, he'll definitely get a shot. I think the important thing for him will be to end up in a place where, you know, where somebody can help channel his passion, let's call it. And you know, it's the kind of thing where it seems like you know, the IO team would be a good place for him to end up. You know, I don't know if there's any chance of that, but that guy has a history of, you know, taking wild kids and calming them down a bit.
Yeah, I think even Aki IO has already given up on Romano Fenati, which maybe says a lot. Speaking of giving up, it does look like perhaps Eugene Laverty's time in MotoGP has come to an end. Eugene Laverty had said that, you know, he only wanted to stick around next year, i.e. 2017, if he could get competitive machinery. It does seem that Alvaro Bautista is certain that Alvaro Bautista will be with the Aspar team on their only GP16, which means that if Laverty were to stay in that team, he would be on an inferior bike, probably the GP15, and Laverty didn't want that. So it does seem that the sort of persistent rumour that he would return to Aprilia in World Superbikes is now going to come true, and it does look like, as rumoured again, Milwaukee will be running the factory Aprilia challenge in World Superbikes, and it seems that Lorenzo Salvadori will be Eugene Laverty's teammate on that Milwaukee Aprilia bike. What that means for Josh Lowes and Carol Abraham, I don't know. I hope that Josh Brooks, who is the other rider on that Milwaukee BMW at the moment, not Lowes, I don't know why I said that, I hope that Brooks can get another ride in World Superbikes. And I'd also like to see Abraham get another ride, just so he can maybe also try and prove himself a bit more, because this season has been fairly dismal for him.
Yeah, really tough for both of those guys. But I think it's a good move for Eugene. You know, it's he knows that he can win races, or, you know, at least he did in the past with Aprilia. You know, if the effort is similar to what it was, he can go and win races and, you know, maybe even be in a shout for the championship. Unfortunately, with all of his talent, you know, having a second string, well, third string Ducati in MotoGP isn't going to let him do anything but, you know, the occasional top 10.
Yeah, I mean, he's getting good results, but it's clear for him that he wants to be challenging for podiums, challenging for race wins, and challenging for a championship. And realistically, you know, unless you're one of the aliens, the only place you can do that is World Superbikes or BSB.
Yeah.
So speaking of changes and World Superbikes, with Romano Fenati out of the Sky VR46 Moto2 team, Francesco Pecco Bagnaia was confirmed as being his replacement, but the Sky VR46 team also said that they have a second seat for next year. Originally, the team was set up to be a one-rider team all about Romano Fenati, but the team changed that, which, you know, some people said was the cause of Fenati's little freakout in Austria. The truth behind that, we will never know. But who will be the second rider has caused a lot of interest. Davide Giuliano, who was in Misano on Tuesday for a Ducati test, he apparently gave a quote where he said that he was talking to Valentino Rossi about the move to Moto2. So Davide Giuliano, he would be quite the addition to the Moto2 pack.
That would be an interesting addition. It reminds me of when Kenan Sofoglu went to Moto2.
Yep, exactly.
Having a wild child from the other paddock.
Yeah, both super, super aggressive. And yeah, as you say, I would love to see Davide Giuliano in the midst of all those teenagers in Moto2, because I think that he could probably show them a thing or two. But it also seems that perhaps Luca Marini or Lorenzo Baldessari could be in the running for that seat. La Marca, a newspaper that Len, you no doubt will know quite well, as it is a Spanish newspaper, they are reporting that the forward team is perhaps on unstable waters in terms of its financial situation, and despite having confirmed Marini and Baldessari for 2017, that they may have to pull out next year.
Interesting. Isn't the forward team sort of the unofficial VR46 Moto2 team?
Yeah, right now, both of their riders are VR46 riders. So yeah, they do have a bit of help from Rossi, but it's also maybe not important, but it's also poignant to remember that Kuzari, the boss and owner of that team, was unable to attend several races last year due to troubles with the Swiss police.
He was on financial holiday.
Yes, for some tax things. So it wouldn't surprise me if there were some financial troubles for the team. Obviously, I hope that team does stick around. You know, it's never good to see a team fold. But hopefully Marini and or Baldessari can land on their feet, because I think especially Baldessari is a rider who has a lot of potential. One of them going to the Sky team could work. It also seems like there will probably be two seats available at least in the Leopard Moto2 team, with Miguel Oliveira going to the Red Bull IO Moto2 KTM team. And then it looks like Danny Kent is in discussions with the AGR team. The AGR team now has an open seat because Marcel Schroeter continues to hop from empty Jonas Folger seat to empty Jonas Folger seat as he joins the Dynavolt Intact GP team to replace Jonas Folger alongside Sandro Cortesi, with Folger moving up to MotoGP. And in more Moto2 news, it looks like Fabio Quartararo is off to the Pons team to ride alongside Edgar Pons. This one's a bit of a head-scratcher, you know?
It doesn't seem like a promotion.
No, it seems very, very odd. You know, Fabio Quartararo, we spoke about it before, so much hype. There were glimpses in that first year of, yeah, you know, this kid's the real deal. But this year, he's just continually fallen flat. You know, he was unable to score this race. He's the only one in that team to have not finished on the podium at least once. He's behind both Mir and Locatelli in the championship. Mir, I can sort of understand, but, you know, based on his previous results, Andrea Locatelli ahead of Fabio Quartararo, that's a real head-scratcher. And it seems like moving to Moto2 is just a bit of a desperate move from Quartararo.
You know, what it makes me wonder is, because it seems that we've had a string now of next big things coming from the CEV, and, you know, not that they've been doing poorly, but, you know, taking a while. And I just, it makes me wonder if the CEV and their Junior World Championship, or I think Moto2 is the European yeah. Championship, you know, whatever they want to cast it as, it is really all that, if it really is so far beyond, you know, other national championships.
I certainly have doubts about Moto2. I think that, you know, unfortunately we've seen from the likes of Jesco Raffin and Edgar Pons, that the champions of that series really, really struggle when they step up. Moto3, I think the big issue with Moto3 is that in Moto3 in a SEV is there's about three or four factory teams. And if you're not in one of those factory teams, then there's no chance of you winning. So I think that maybe skews the results a bit.
Right.
But, you know, maybe he can turn it around in Moto2. It just seems very odd that he'd only spend two very mixed years in Moto3, and then to say, I'm moving up a class to a class which is famous for sort of ending careers prematurely.
Yeah, it'll, well, I don't know. It seems like there's not much probability of it working out well and a lot of ways that it could work out poorly.
Yeah, exactly, unfortunately. And speaking of prematurely, Alex Lowes, he got to test Paul Espargaro's Monster Tech 3 M1 as a reward for helping to win the Suzuka 8-hour. Unfortunately, since his last name is Lowes, the test only lasted 15 laps before he crashed.
Oh, ouch.
I joke. Although they do crash a bit. Although Sam didn't crash this weekend that much.
They try hard.
They definitely push it, you know. Fair play to him. He got a chance to ride a MotoGP bike. Could be his only chance. So he said, you know, I'm going to find the limit of this thing. It's just that, unfortunately, the limit ended up with him sliding along the floor. He and the bike were relatively okay. So no major issues there. And then his brother Sam, he was off to, I believe, Misano for a 2-day test on the Aprilia MotoGP bike. So he'll have a lot of experience before he moves up to that bike next year. And Alicia Spargaro was telling him not to learn too much because obviously Alicia Spargaro still hasn't tested the Aprilia.
Yeah, when I read about Alex crashing the Yamaha, I just thought, my God, you know, how do you feel? How do you walk back into the garage when you've done something like that? You know, I rode a friend's bike on track one time and rode it off the track but didn't crash.
Yeah.
And I felt bad enough for that. And I just wondered, how, you know, do you just walk in and say, oh, well, you know, whatever, that's, you know, that's part of the game, or...
I think you just walk in and say, faulty Michelin front, you know, same as those wet tires, not my fault.
Exactly. It's those tires.
So now we can actually come on to the racing, and it was a pretty interesting weekend in the Czech Republic, you know, Friday and Saturday. Glorious weather, absolutely perfect. But then on Sunday, it absolutely bucketed down, so the whole thing got turned on its head. But of course, as Saturday was clear, we did have a dry qualifying, and it was Brad Binder who took pole position in the Moto3 class, a 207.785. He was provisionally ahead of Andrea Migno, Emilio Bastianini, Jorge Martin, matching his best ever qualifying result and ending as the top Mahindra. Fabio De Giannantonio in fifth, really good result from the rookie. Belega sixth, Antonelli seventh, Ertl eighth, Canet ninth, Cornfile tenth, McPhee 11th, great result from McPhee, ahead of Jorge Navarro. Then Carol Haneke in 13th as a wild card, good result from him, ahead of Juan Mir, Juan Fran Guevara in 15th, Fabio Quartararo in 16th place. And those are all sort of the Carl Idempawi, we should probably note him, he was 29th, although the grid would change as Fabio Quartararo, he got like 3 or 4 different penalties for various things. And then Migno, his best lap time got cut for exceeding track limits, so that moved Bastianini to second and Jorge Martin up to third. And then of course, as it was wet, basically, the entire grid was set into disarray, and everyone just set their eyes firmly on Kyle Idempawi and said, all right, how many laps before he hits the front? Once the flag dropped, coming from 29th, it took him a while to get going, but Powie did eventually get going, and he was charging through pretty well. But while he was charging ahead, we had an excellent race start from Jorge Martin. He was leading for a fair few laps at the start and got a pretty comfortable gap. But then the likes of Brad Binder, John McPhee, and Fabio De Giannantonio, they hunted down Jorge Martin and passed him. And then it was Binder and McPhee breaking away at the front. Binder was pretty comfortable in the lead, you know, cruising along. And then as happened to so many other riders, Binder went down and made his first mistake of the year. Binder was pretty annoyed at himself, understandably so, for the mistake. But it did hand John McPhee the lead of the race. He had a pretty solid lead, but Kyle Idempawi was in second place. You know, this was maybe halfway through the race, so Powie had been making, as everyone expected, a great charge through the field. His lap times were significantly faster than McPhee, and everyone thought, all right, you know, here we go, third time this year. But then Powie crashed as well.
Yeah, amazing. Super unexpected. I was at the track riding, and I was watching the race half Twitter, half on my phone. And when it got to the point where it was, you know, first Binder in front and then Powie on his way, I thought, well, you know, we know where this is ending.
Yeah.
And I was super surprised.
Yep, exactly. So with that, John McPhee then had a 10-second lead, but he couldn't quite read his pit board, so didn't know if it said 12 seconds or 1.2 seconds. So he kept on pushing. And then 3 laps from the end, he had an absolutely massive, massive moment. And if you don't follow Andrew Northcott on social media, then you really should. AJRN, he's a photographer, been doing it for an age. And he has the most incredible photo of John McPhee, who must be 3 feet out of the seat, as he just has this huge moment, which was much bigger than either Powie or Binder had. But somehow McPhee managed to stay on the bike and eventually cross the line in first place for his first ever Grand Prix victory, the first Scottish win since like 1961, I think the stat was. The second victory for Mahindra of the year. Obviously, that Peugeot is a rebranded Mahindra. And then behind, Jorge Navarro, he was also having a pretty good ride, and he looked set for at least a podium finish. It was Aaron Canet who looked almost set for a podium finish, but then he crashed as well. So that meant that Jorge Martin eventually managed to wrestle past Fabio De Gianantonio. So Jorge Martin took his first ever podium, which also gave Mahindra their first ever 1-2. And then Fabio De Gianantonio, he took yet another podium in his what is turning out to be an incredible rookie season.
Yeah, and it's incredible to see Mahindra doing so well so soon. I mean, you're going to know a lot better than I have, but it's not been a lot of years that they've been, you know, been in Moto3 and going from, you know, kind of making up numbers to being, you know, front runners.
Yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah, I mean, you know, everyone in the team was really happy. As I said on the last show, I am the press officer for Mahindra, so you know, grain of salt and all that. But no, it was an incredible result. You know, McPhee is a super, super nice dude, and it was so good to see him get a victory. And I'm sure that he'll be hoping for a wet British GP.
Yeah. And I think that the real interesting thing here is it's easy for us to sort of get, you know, get complacent and watch the races and think, well, you know, we know what's going to happen, without thinking of, you know, just what a knife's edge these guys are on all the time, especially in the wet.
Mm.
And absolutely anything can happen.
Yeah, exactly. And that is the big thing in the wet, is it takes just a fraction of a second to lose concentration, you know, to forget to roll off the throttle or to ease off your brakes, just a meter. Too soon or too late, and then you end up like Brad Binder or like Kyrell Inamppowie. Fortunately for Binder, you know, with Jorge Navarro not having the best finish in the world, it hasn't done Binder's championship too much harm. Jorge Navarro was 10th, so, you know, he's not making up too many points on Binder. It is still obviously Brad Binder who leads the way, 179 points to Jorge Navarro's 118 points. Enea Bastianini actually moves to third in the championship with 94 points. Fanardi is still fourth. Unfortunately, Francesco Bagnaia slips back down to fifth place. He crashed during the race, so that was quite disappointing for him. Nicolo Belega, he's sixth out of Juan Mir, 89 points for Belega, 83 points for Mir. So a nice little battle there for Rookie of the Year, and potentially even, you know, a top three for them. Fabio De Gianantonio, he's also in that Rookie of the Year battle on 82. All three of those guys are ahead of Nicolo Antonelli on 74. Jakob Kornfahl, somewhat surprisingly, in 10th with 68 points. We haven't really seen that much from Kornfahl this year. He did quite well at the start of this race, but then sort of faded back. Powie 11th, Locatelli 12th, Fabio Quartararo, as we said, in 13th place. Fabio Quartararo in that race, he finished in 21st spot and wow, almost 2 minutes behind the race winner, John McPhee. So a bit of a head scratcher there again from Fabio Quartararo. We also had quite a nasty crash for Albert Arenas. Unfortunately, he broke his right collarbone. So that means that he'll probably also be out of the Sev round this coming weekend in Portugal. So a pretty big bummer for him there.
Yeah, you know what I'm happiest about with the Moto3 results, Harry?
What?
We managed to avoid really bad puns based on anybody's surname.
What, McPhee McFast?
Well, I was thinking of somebody who might have been it.
Oh yeah, I didn't even think of that.
Very good, very good. We're professionals, sort of, not really.
Exactly, professional, straight and focused. So, speaking of professional, Moto2, they're professional riders as well. We had Moto2 qualifying, and it got off to a bit of a rocky start, as Tom Lüthi had a really, really old, I guess it was a rocky end to the session, sorry, that happened at the end. Thomas Lüthi had a really big high side, and I think that was his second crash of the weekend, but he sort of got caught up with the bike and it just didn't look good at all, so that's a red flag the session so that he could be taken to hospital. air quotes, fortunately, Luti was okay, and he, air quotes, only had a concussion and, you know, some other various small injuries. He was obviously out of the race, but, you know, really good to hear that it wasn't anything life-threatening. So all our wishes do go out to Tom Luti for a speedy recovery. But it was Johann Zarco, unsurprisingly, who took pole position ahead of Sam Lowes. Again, not too surprising that Lowes was up there. But then third place went to Alex Marquez, who I had to do a double take when I saw Alex Marquez getting interviewed in Parc Fermé. I'm not going to lie.
Because but people were already saying that he really likes Bruneau.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, him and Danny Kent, to be fair to both of them, you know, they both did well this weekend. Kent had qualified eighth, but then had his best lap time removed for running illegal tyre pressures. And, you know, Sandro Cortese, again, another former Moto3 world champion, he got his first podium in Moto2 in Brno. So, you know, maybe it's something about that track that does suit those former Moto3 guys, because it seems odd that all three of those riders would have had such success at the same track, given their backgrounds. But maybe it's just a coincidence. I don't know. Then it was Takaaki Nakagami who led the second row. Tom Luti had provisionally qualified in fifth place. Morbidelli sixth. Alex Rins seventh. As I said, Danny Kent was provisionally in eighth before getting dropped down. I think it was like to 16th. Jonas Folger ninth. Corsi Oliveira in 11th place. You know, Lorenzo Baldessari had a pretty tough time in 20th. And then your usual suspects. And then 29th on the grid on a 2013 suitor was Anthony West, who continues to just pop up everywhere. You know, every championship. Oh, is there a race this weekend? Yeah. Oh, Anthony West probably riding.
Yeah, it's great to see. I follow him on a few different places on social media, and it's funny to see his vagabond life. He seems to take it pretty well. You know, I don't think he has any illusions that he's going to go winning any races, but he's still there. You know, it feels like one of these continental circus guys from the 60s and 70s.
Yeah, I've never seen a guy as ready as Ant West to sleep in his car and seem sort of okay with it. It's very bizarre. But then, you know, as with Moto3, we got to race day and it was pouring with rain. So, you know, pretty much anything could happen. And pretty much anything did happen. Johann Zarco had a pretty disastrous race by Johann Zarco standards. He was outside the points at several stages in the race. We had crashes from Nakagami, Luca Marini, Axel Pons somewhat unsurprisingly. Rathapat Wilerot, I think he had at least one crash, maybe even two. But it was Jonas Folger who produced a great wet weather ride. Folger really, really good in the wet. And Folger took victory ahead of Alex Rins and Sam Lowes. So overall for Rins and for Lowes, really good for their championship to get those results, with Zarco only finishing in 11th place. Then a huge shout out to Matteo Pessini in 4th. What a ride from the Italian there.
Yeah, although he got he had kind of a rough move with somebody there at the very, very end, didn't he? I think that might have been who's the Italian-Brazilian guy?
Morbidelli.
Morbidelli.
Yeah. I know that Simone Corsi, speaking of rough moves, he also had to do a ride-through penalty for a move on, I believe it was Wilerot, although it might have been Nakagami. It was definitely one of the Idemitsu bikes. But that's not the first time that Simone Corsi has been penalised for a hard move or two.
No, not at all.
And then we had Alex Marquez in 5th. Good result from him, hopefully building the confidence. Hafiz Sayon in 6th. Danny Kent, a really, really good ride to 7th place for him, ahead of Franco Morbidelli. Then Miguel Oliveira in 9th with Anthony West. Of course, as it was a wet race, you can guarantee that Anthony West was going to be in the top 10. Anthony West could ride a unicycle into the top 10 in a wet race. Westy, you know, 2013 Suda's first points of the year. Good for him, good for them. I was sort of hoping, you know, not only as an Australian, but also just for that fairy tale story that Westy could win once again in the wet, you know, come from the back, 29th on the grid to take victory. But it couldn't be. But, you know, getting a top 10 on a 2013 Suda is pretty special, I think.
With a very dodgy front fender.
Yeah, if you haven't seen the front fender, go onto my Twitter, HLPhotoGP. The front fender just looked like it was a bit of like, you know, those binders you get for school to keep your papers in. It sort of looked like they just stuck two of those to the front of the bike.
A complete bodge. I don't know what bike that's off of, but I can guarantee it's not from a suitor.
Yeah, and I can't imagine that it's that hard to get or even to make a front fender. Surely you could just go rip a front fender off, you know, another race bike or even like a CBR 600 and just put that on. surely that would be better than the monstrosity that they had constructed.
I can just imagine some guy in the garage the night before quoting Fast Times at Ridgemont High, telling him, dude, my dad's got an awesome set of tools. I can fix it.
Yeah, but things like this also seem to follow Ant West around. Like when he was racing for MZ in Moto2, I heard a story that they had made an exhaust pipe out of scrap metal they had found in the MZ parking lot.
Very good. That's Queensland ingenuity or something like that, right?
Yeah, exactly. So behind Westy was Zarco, then Vieje in 12th, Julian Simon in 13th, Isaac Vinales in 14th, with Xavier Simeon in 15th, ahead of Baldessari, Agata, Schroeter, Corsi, Edgar Pons, Remy Gardner in 21st, Robin Mulhauser, Sandro Cortese, Jesco Raffin, and then down one lap was Rathapot Willerott. Much like Moto3, that race did give Rins and Lowe's a bit of a chance to close up on Zarco, but Zarco does retain the championship lead, 181 points versus the 162 points of Rins and the 137 of Lowe's. In all honesty, it seems very, very tough for Lowe's to win the championship. Rins needs to really start beating Zarco consistently now to close that 19-point gap. But it is doable, whereas with Lowe's being, 44 points behind, that's pretty big. Then Jonas Folger, he's fourth overall with 108, 2 points ahead of Tom Lutie. Franco Morbidelli in sixth with 94 points. Nakagami in seventh with 92. Huffy Siren in 8th with 79, then Agata in 9th with 71, and then a pretty big gap there to Simone Corsi in 10th with 59 points.
Yeah, for me, the real important thing in the finishing order was, you know, first to see Jonas Folger win something in Moto2 before going to MotoGP, I think is really important.
Yeah, I'm sure Hervé Poncharal is pretty pleased about that.
Yeah, because if not, you'll have Carl Abraham syndrome, you know, people asking for the rest of your life, you know, what are you doing there? So I think it's good for him that he won. And then for Alex Rins to start doing well again. I think a lot of people were starting to wonder, you know, was he really the next big thing? What's going on? What's happening with him?
Yeah, Cedo Pons was really questioning Alex Rins this weekend. Rins hadn't had the best weekend in the lead up to the race, and
yep.
Yeah, Cedo Pons, I think it was on the Dorna feed, was a bit critical of Alex Rins.
Yeah, and it makes you wonder how Rins would have done had it been dry. You know, I probably wouldn't have been challenging for the podium, but you know, something is something, and hopefully that gets him, gets him not just used to being up there again, but gets some of his feel and some of his confidence back.
Yeah, exactly, because you know we do like those nice tight championships. So now we move on to the big boys, to MotoGP. Throughout the whole weekend, actually, including in Moto2, we had one or two incidents where bikes went over the fence. Cal Crutchlow had a bike go over the fence. I believe Lutie had a bike go over the fence. And of course, last year, we had Rossi's bike go over the fence and actually hit one of the BMW X5 VIP experience cars. So maybe something needs to be reviewed at Brno. But luckily, no one was injured in any of those crashes. But it was a bit worrying. So he came into Q1, and yet again, Danny Pedrosa had to go through Q1. This is really not Danny Pedrosa's season. You know, we saw a flash of brilliance in Barcelona, and we thought, okay, Danny Pedrosa's back, he's fully fit, you know, he's starting to turn the bike around. But since then, it seems like he's just struggling more and more and more.
Yeah, I don't know what's going on with him or the bike, or you know, his bike obviously is something different than Marquez's bike, but whatever it is, it's just not working for him. Talk about an absolute just a disaster weekend.
Yeah, exactly. It's disappointing to see, because you know, we know how good Danny Pedrosa is, but he's just unable to show that at the moment, unfortunately. So it was him and Bradley Smith who advanced through into Q2. Daniele Petrucci, he just missed out. He qualified ahead of Scott Redding, Eugene Laverty, Stefan Bradl, Loris Baz, Yoni Hernandez, Alvaro Bautista, and then Tito Rabat rounded out Q1. Unfortunately, but I think wisely, Jack Miller was not allowed to race this weekend. He had been passed fit by the medical team, but Mark VDS and HRC sort of said, no, you're not racing with a broken right wrist and a cracked T6 vertebra, which I personally believe was the right call to be made.
Oh, definitely. I mean, because one thing is being able to do some press-ups and show that you're strong and fit, but, you know, hit that vertebra the wrong way and it's going to all be, you know, very, very sad.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, the risks outweigh the benefit. You know, sure, given the circumstances, maybe Miller could have challenged for a race win again. But had it not been wet, you know, Miller would have been lucky to score points given his physical condition. Yeah. And he's still a really young guy. So, you know, as you say, there's no point risking, you know, incredible damage to yourself. So definitely a good call by Honda to make. And then we came to Q2. And already this weekend, Marc Marquez had continued to put our jaws on the floor. He seemed to do this every weekend where he just keeps outdoing himself with incredible saves. But I can't remember at what point in the weekend, but he had just the most incredible slide that he somehow managed to pick up off his elbow. And so, you know, already the weekend was off to a pretty impressive start for Marc Marquez. But then in qualifying on his hot lap, he cut through traffic like I have never seen. I believe it was Valentino Rossi and Paul Espargaro.
Yeah.
He threaded the needle absolutely perfectly around the outside, up the inside, around the outside to get past those guys and set pole position. And it was magic to watch.
Yeah, as he was coming up on them, I was thinking, well, that's his lap ruined. There's absolutely no way that he's going to go for it.
Especially with Rossi.
Yeah, yeah. As hard as it's going to have to be with Rossi in qualifying, not in the race, definitely. But in qualifying, I just didn't think that he was going to go for it that hard. And for me, the amazing thing was, like you said, how finely he threaded the needle, but how clean he made it.
Yeah, yeah. I don't think any of the three stood up at any point. Maybe Rossi had to lift up a bit, but it was absolutely immaculate. As always, the MotoGP.com official Twitter, they have little video clips of that. So be sure to go scroll through those if you missed any of them. So he's pretty much stole pole position from Jorge Lorenzo. Lorenzo looked really, really strong in qualifying. Both Marquez and Lorenzo were the only two riders in the 154s, a 154.5 for Marquez and a 154.8 for Jorge Lorenzo. Both of those were new lap records, I believe. So, you know, Michelin were doing pretty well at Brno. We'll get to how they did in the wet in a bit. Then completing the front row was Andrea Iannone. Good to see him up there again. You know, clearly that Ducati is working well. And then perhaps the best thing about the top four was that Alicia Spargaro and the Suzuki was fourth. So we had four different manufacturers in that top four. Always good to see. Then we had Hector Barbera yet again in fifth spot. Top independent rider. He was ahead of Valentino Rossi, Dovizioso in 7th, Vinales 8th. Pedrosa eventually did manage to get himself into the top 10 with 9th, ahead of Cal Crutchlow. Crutchlow had his quite big crash during FP4, so he was a bit shaken up, so pretty good 10th place for him. And then the Tech 3 boys of Bradley Smith and Paul Espargaro rounded out the top 12.
Yeah, interesting results there, like you said. You know, I can imagine that a lot of Andrea Iannone, I mean, aside from the bike doing, you know, being very good, we know that, we've seen that so far. The confidence that he's got to be carrying from Austria must be tremendous.
Yep, and Andrea Iannone was already a pretty confident dude, maybe yes. Overly so. So, although it is interesting, right? Because you look at Romano Fenati and Andrea Iannone, and, you know, from the outside looking in, it seems like those two guys have a pretty similar personality. You know, Iannone, he had that infamous incident where he headbutted Paul Espargaro after taking him out. I think it was in Misano in the 125s. Fenati's had his whole things, but it's clear that throughout his time, Iannone and the people around Iannone have been able to challenge Iannone's anger and aggression and all that sort of thing into racing, as opposed to having it spill out into other areas. So hopefully Fenati can look to Iannone as a bit of inspiration for how to behave, which is a sentence that I never thought I'd say, but there you go.
Andrea Iannone, role model.
Yeah, exactly. Soon we'll see Romano Fenati with hard dick every time as his Twitter description, just like Iannone when he was in Moto2.
Oh my God.
Yep. Iannone is a character. But then we got to the race and it had been absolutely pouring for Moto2 and Moto3, but the rain had eased off before MotoGP, which caused several riders to risk, or to what they didn't think was a risk, but what we found out to be a big risk, to risk the soft Michelin rain tyres. I believe it was only Cal Crutchlow and Loris Baz who went for the full hard front and rear tyre combination. Now, as the race got underway, it seemed like that was a mistake. Cal Crutchlow dropped down to like 15th spot and really seemed to be struggling. And Loris Baz, he wasn't doing that great either, but, you know, Loris Baz, obviously, his qualifying wasn't that great to begin with. And we had Dovizioso, he shot off at the front. He was pretty closely followed by the likes of Scott Redding. Meanwhile, Jorge Lorenzo and Valentino Rossi, both of those guys just dropped back and back and back. For Lorenzo, not a huge surprise in the wet. For Rossi, quite surprising that he was dropping super far back. And then I believe it was Andrea Dovizioso who had the first of the tire issues. He ran on and then started shaking his head as, you know, yet again, Andrea Dovizioso's bad luck seemed to strike. He'd been leading the race, looking pretty good in the wet, as he always does. And then there was some issue with the bike. So then he came into the pits. And then did he change bikes immediately, or was his second bike still fitted with slick tires? I can't remember.
I seem to remember him coming in and nothing happening very quickly. He was standing around. He was talking to people. So I think they had to do something to his second bike.
Yeah, because that was the issue, is that a lot of the bikes in pit lane were fitted with slick tires because most people were thinking that the track would dry. So Dovizioso, he came in and then he went out and then he came back in and had to retire from the race. So disaster.
Yeah, because I think even if he went out, I think he probably went out with a bike that had rain tires, but probably a dry, you know, shock and front fork setup.
Yeah, exactly. So that would have been a disaster. And he eventually just called it a day, knowing that he couldn't do anything. Then we had Jorge Lorenzo come in. And this whole incident was incredible to watch live because nobody had any idea what the hell was going on. The commentators didn't know. Romano Fucada, Jorge Lorenzo's crew chief, he had no idea. So Lorenzo came into pit lane and then jumped across to his second bike, which, like Dovi's second bike, was set up with slick tires. And Fucada is just there going, no, no, what are you doing? You're a lunatic. Have you seen how wet it is out there? But Jorge Lorenzo sort of shook him off and headed back out. And what had happened is that, like Dovizioso, and like we'd find out later with Iannone, is that basically the center strip of Lorenzo's front rain tire, which was the soft Michelin, had started chunking off. So there was basically no center tread on the tire. But the problem was that when Lorenzo rolled into pit lane, the chunks that were missing were the part that were contacting the ground. So his team thought, the tire's fine, what's he doing?
Yeah.
And it wasn't till later when Lorenzo came back in to change back to his wet bike that they finally understood what had happened.
Well, and it wasn't just his team. It was all of the internet.
Yeah, exactly.
Which I think is a really important point because people, I mean, it's so easy to jump to conclusions. And I'm no Jorge Lorenzo fan. You know, I dogpile on him a bit as well sometimes. But it's real easy, you know, to think that we all know what's going on and everybody's, you know, plugged into the action via Twitter. But the only people that have any idea what's going on in all of the races is the guys riding the bikes.
Yeah.
And I think that was one thing that we hopefully learned last weekend.
Yep, exactly. So Lorenzo, as we said, he came in, then got on back on his bike with the correct setup, and basically he just went out there to unlap himself, and he eventually finished 17th. Which, yeah, you know, sort of cements this is by far Jorge Lorenzo's worst run of races in the Premier class ever. It seems like, you know, Valentino Rossi, who we'll get to in a second, he basically confirmed that Rossi, his goal is just to cement second in the championship. And with Jorge Lorenzo now slipping to third overall in the championship, it seems like there's no realistic chance of anyone stopping Marc Marquez for the title.
It doesn't look that way. I mean, I don't wish anything bad on Marc Marquez, but that's the only way that anybody else is going to win the championship.
Yeah, exactly. Out the front, you know, some people don't like wet races. When I was standing there getting absolutely soaking wet because I found out my jacket wasn't waterproof, which is a great thing to find out on race day when everything else you have is in a suitcase in the hotel. So I was soaking wet, but despite that, I really enjoy wet weather races. And as we saw in Assen, they give the guys that you wouldn't usually expect a chance to shine. You know, we've seen it all throughout history, you know, Westy, Kyrill Adampowy, Christopher Mullen, all those guys. And it was the turn of yet another guy to shine in the wet. It was Cal Crutchlow, who, as we said a little bit before, had opted for the hard, hard rain tires. Now, had the track dried out, this would have been an absolutely disastrous move. But because the track stayed wet, those final laps saw Crutchlow absolutely flying, and he was incredible to watch. You know, he was going around the outside of guys. He just had so much pace on those tires. And perhaps the only thing better to watch than Cal Crutchlow's ride was Lucio Ceccanello's reactions in the box, because that guy was having kittens.
Telling him to slow down, slow down.
Yeah, exactly. But it was Cal Crutchlow who would eventually take victory. It looked like Valentino Rossi might have been able to challenge him for a bit, but Rossi was unable to do it. So Cal Crutchlow, just ahead of the British GP, finally ended Britain's winning drought in Grand Prix motorcycle racing. 35 years and like, what would that be? And 35 years and six days, I think it was, after Barry Sheen won in Anderstorp on the 16th of August, Cal Crutchlow took victory. It's been a pretty big month for Cal Crutchlow. He had a baby. And, you know, in his post-race interview, he did say that having a baby or, you know, creating a baby, you know, obviously he didn't physically have it himself. He said that that was the best feeling in the world, but winning a GP comes pretty darn close. It was also, I thought it was quite nice to see him immediately on the phone to Lucy, his wife, who obviously can't travel with a baby that young. And yeah, you know, Cal Crutchlow, he divides opinion and all that sort of stuff. But after we had, after Dave had that chat with him in Barcelona, where I thought Crutchlow was very honest, you know, that brought Cal Crutchlow up a lot in my books. And much like Miller, it's nice to see the good guys get a chance to win.
Yeah, yeah. Like you said about the tires, I mean, he sort of, threading the needle, but this night, not between riders, but between conditions.
Mm.
You know, had it been super soaked and cold, the hard might not have been in the choice, and had it dried out, it wouldn't have been the choice. But it was just, you know, just that tiny bit dry enough to give that, whether it was a lucky call or a skillful call in choosing the tires, it really, really worked out for him.
Yeah. Exactly. Interestingly enough, Jack Miller before the race, Jack Miller obviously not racing, Jack Miller had said, I think I'm going to put a cheeky bet on Cal Crutchlow for the race win, and it turned out to be right. So everyone...
Did he make the bet?
I don't know if he actually did. I'd heard rumours that Jack Miller got a six-figure sum for winning in Assen, so I don't think he needs to make any bets for a little while. But you probably would have gotten pretty good odds on Cal Crutchlow, so that would have been a good one. I know that there was definitely at least one MotoGP commentator who made a decent little bit of money from betting on John McPhee before the weekend began. But yeah, Cal Crutchlow took his first ever Grand Prix victory, as I said, Britain's first, just ahead of the British Grand Prix, with McPhee winning and then Lowe's second in the Moto2 race. Was Lowe's second or was he third? I can't remember. Anyway, it doesn't matter. He was on the podium. So, you know, a great result for all our British fans out there just ahead of the British GP. Hopefully it does sell some more tickets or at least get some more people interested, because, you know, it's always good to have new blood in. Behind Cal Crutchlow was Valentino Rossi, who stole second place from Marc Marquez. Loris Baz, who also had opted for those hard tyres. He was a really, really great fourth place ahead of Hector Barbera. Barbera, he was really working hard to try and find the wet patches out on track to save his tyre, which was degrading pretty bad. Laverty was sixth. Petrucci, seventh. Iannone. Iannone's tyre was absolutely gone. I mean,
more than just the center strip, yeah.
It looked like something that you'd find, you know, on the side of the road after a blowout, but somehow Iannone managed to ride it home in eighth place, ahead of Maverick Viñales, Tito Rabat in 10th, Hernandez in 11th, Danny Pedrosa, a very lackluster 12th place, ahead of Paul Espargaro, Stefan Bradl, Scott Redding in 15th, Bautista 16th, and then, as we said, Jorge Lorenzo in 17th position. Alicia Espargaro, he had to jump off his Suzuki because it seemed like it was catching fire, which is always less than ideal.
Yeah, Jorge Lorenzo finishing last like that. I have to say, I always get a chuckle out of his pre-race routine, you know, leaving the grid and, I don't know, going off and trying to extinguish fires in his head probably as much as anything else. And with this, like you said, this last series of races, I just... because he seems to be a confidence rider,
yeah,
you know,
for sure.
when everything's going well for him, and you can see it in his manner, you know, the way that he struts around the paddock and things like that. But when it's going bad for him, it just seems to feed on itself. Poor guy. I hope he can find something to set that right.
I think that the significant cash check waiting for him next year and the glowing red GP17 is probably enough to keep his spirits up.
Well, I mean, yeah, that'll be nice when it happens. But, you know, I think the hunger that these guys have,
yeah, no, for sure.
I don't think even money satisfies. You know, yes, the money's a big chunk of it, you know, and they'll all say it if they're being honest. But at the end of the day, it's a very animal thing that drives them.
Yeah, for sure. And there was a post-race test in Brno the following Monday. And Jorge Lorenzo, obviously, since he's off to Ducati, he didn't get to test any of the 2017 parts, but Rossi tested a couple of things, and Rossi is really eager to get a new frame as soon as possible on that M1. So it'll be interesting to see.
But you know what I wondered when I read that? Is that Rossi being genuinely excited about the new parts, or is he just having a dig at Lorenzo? Is he just letting Lorenzo know, oh my God, boy, do I have something good, and oh boy, are you just not getting it?
It could be that, you know. I wouldn't put it past the doctor. Yeah, it'll be interesting to see if Yamaha do bring any upgrades or if they do just save it for 2017. Because, you know, Valentino Rossi himself said in the post-race press conference that the rest of this season is all about beating Jorge Lorenzo and getting second in the championship. It yeah. seems like Rossi himself has already accepted that Marc Marquez is going to be the champion, and maybe, you know, maybe Yamaha go along with him. And now just shift all of their attention to 2017. I don't know. That's something.
Yeah. Only you know, at this point, I wonder, is Rossi going for championships anymore, or is he just going for wins to beat Ego?
It might be an unpopular opinion. I don't know. It's hard to tell, right? I think that every year since returning to Yamaha, he probably wasn't thinking it at Ducati. But the last couple of years, I think Rossi definitely lines up in Qatar thinking that he can be champion, especially after last year, right? You know, he got so close and he proved that he still has the pace. But I'm sure that after one or two rounds this year, he probably realized, okay, this isn't realistically going to happen. Let's just get the wins. I think that after the race in Qatar next year, depending on how Lorenzo and Marquez do, then that will decide how Rossi feels for that year.
Yeah, fair enough. Yeah,
because
yeah.
I think if he can stay with them, you know, more or less, you know, Qatar's never been super kind to the Yamahas or to Rossi. But, you know, if he can stay with them, maybe thinks, okay, we can probably do this. But if Marquez and Lorenzo are battling for the lead 10 seconds ahead of Rossi, then I think that it will be, okay, let's just get as many wins as we can. Two more years of just winning it, trying to do as best we can to beat Ago, as you say. Because, yeah, it seems like, I don't know, you know, last year proved a lot of people wrong, but it seems like every year a 10th title gets harder and harder. You know, Marc Marquez, he's obviously incredible. Jorge Lorenzo does have the potential to be incredible next year, a bit of an unknown. But then you also have guys like Maverick Vinales now coming through, who's going to be Rossi's teammate on the same bike. And that's just adding more pressure. You know, it's more young guys. Ducati are continuing to get stronger and stronger. So it's guys like Dovizioso now getting thrown into the mix more. And, you know, even guys like Barbera and Laverty on the satellite bikes, the satellite Ducatis are becoming a challenge. So it's definitely getting tougher and tougher.
Getting tougher. And I think in two ways, like you said, you know, the really good young guys, you know, Marquez as an example. And then I think, you know, just this year we've seen the new rules have somewhat evened things out.
Yeah, and whether there'll be a dramatic shift next year, I don't know. I personally don't think that unless the FIM, Dorna, and the MSMA change something dramatic in the rules, not just the winglets, that it will stay close. You know, obviously I think the factories will keep making steps and steps and steps ahead of the satellite teams, but I think that we'll still see it a bit more mixed up, especially in these wet races, at least hopefully so. You know, yeah. six races, six different winners, that's pretty incredible. As we said, which listener was it? It was scrolling up. It was James Dewitt who said, you know, first time we've had it's the longest streak of different winners since 1999. So that's pretty good. And I think it shows that the championship is heading in a more exciting direction after years and years of it being Danny Pedrosa, Casey Stoner, Jorge Lorenzo, Valentino Rossi, Marc Marquez.
Yeah, yeah. And it's lucky for us, you know, we could be watching Formula One, but we've got this.
Exactly. If only the championship itself were as exciting. As we said, it is still Marc Marquez who leads 197 points. That puts him 53 points clear of Valentino Rossi. Two race wins. You know, as we say, anything's possible, right? But when even Valentino Rossi himself is saying that the championship's over, the championship is probably over. So Rossi, 144 points, ahead of Jorge Lorenzo by 6 points, so at least going to have an exciting battle for second place. Danny Pedrosa is fourth with 109. Now starting to come under real, real pressure from Maverick Viñales on the Suzuki, 100 points. Then Iannone on 96 points. He's recovering well, so he could also have a pretty good battle for fourth place. Paul Espargaró on 81 points, ahead of Dovi on 79, who is in turn 3 points ahead of Hector Barbera on 76. Then Cal Crutchlow enters the top 10 thanks to his win and now has 66 points. Then Eugene Laverty, Scott Redding, Alicia Spargaro, Jack Miller, Bradley Smith, Stefan Bradl, Daniele Petrucci, Bautista, Rabat, Baz, Pirro, and then Yoni Hernandez, who still only has 8 points. And that is more or less the Czech GP weekend. It was a pretty great weekend, you know, especially for all the Brits out there. I know that there was definitely a tear in Nick Harris's eye as he was commentating and, you know, remembering that fateful weekend with Barry and all that sort of stuff. So it was good to see people really, really excited for a new race winner. And, you know, as we've said a couple of times on this show, last year ended on a pretty ugly note, but it seems like everything this year is sort of paved over that, and we're back to more or less being the sport that we all know and love.
Yeah, nice in that sense.
Exactly, but there is just enough needle in there to keep it interesting. And we now have a weekend off, or some of us do. There's obviously the Spanish Championship in BSB this weekend, so there's always bike racing on the TV. But whoever organized the calendar this year with a double, a weekend off, and then another double, they need to be executed, because it is no fun. I'm sorry, but let's week on, week off, week on, week off. That works well for everyone. This whole back-to-back thing is not fun.
And with you doing MotoGP and CEV and stuff in the BSB, it's bikes from April to October.
Yes, I know that from now until the end of Misano, I don't have a single day off. And beyond that, I don't want to look at my calendar, because I may have a heart attack and spontaneously combust.
You'll be fine. Just keep drinking those vitamin drinks that you drink.
Yes, exactly. My excellent vitamin drinks with added vitamins for extra boost. Actually, I haven't had that much this show. It's sort of just sitting there. But anyway, that's been pretty much the show from us. As we said, we will do a show next week to cover the BSB and the SEV stuff, and then we'll be in Silverstone. Both Dave and I will be there. I'm not sure about anyone else. I'll have to double check with Martin. I know that he's currently in the UK, but I'm not sure when he goes back to the Middle East. So as I said at the top of the show, Dave and I will, fingers crossed, be organizing a MotoPod meetup. It'll probably be during like Moto2 FP something. So be sure to check Twitter and Facebook for all of those details. And if in doubt, motopod@motopodcast is the email address that goes to all the hosts. You know, you can send in an email, you can ask us questions, get it read on the show, don't get it read on the show, whatever you want. We love replying to them. And hopefully you like hearing our replies.
All right. Well, good chatting to you again, Harry.
Yeah, excellent to have you back on the show, Len, as always. It's good that we now have a wider variety of hosts. We did have Skylar Vicroy offer to be on the show tonight, but unfortunately he's not available until quite late due to the time difference, and I have to get my beauty sleep. But I have a feeling that in the not too distant future, we will have one of those 3 to 4 host shows that we used to do quite regularly coming up. So everyone, I hope you look forward to those.
Great. Well, good stuff. And look forward to hearing from you from Portimao next weekend.
Yep. As always, that'll be free on YouTube. So do tune into that one. And until then, have a good one, everyone. And we'll catch you next week.
All right. So long.